My name is Dave Levine. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, a show dedicated to discussing technology issues from different perspectives, primarily from the perspective of the non-lawyer and the non-techie. And today's show is really going to be one that I think kind of moves us back in the world of law a little bit more than we have generally, but I think it's going to be a great discussion. Today's topic is the elusive but fascinating area of law known as patents. Patents take up one of the four major areas of intellectual property law: copyright, trademark, trade secrets, and patents being last. And it's really an area, especially from a technology perspective, but also from a business perspective, that has a lot of interesting developments, some interesting case law, and really a pretty wide application, not only in the tech sector, but also, like I said, in anyone that's looking to make an invention or create an invention or think of a new idea or go to work for a business. I'm very pleased today to be continuing my run of drawing on the wealth of knowledge that exists at the Center for Internet and Society, where I am a resident fellow, because with me today is David Olson, the other resident fellow. In our office, we're known as the Davids because we both have the same first name. Strangely, we also have the same middle initial as well. So for those of you that were really wondering, boy, it would be great if I heard both of the resident fellows from CAS on the radio at the same time. Today's your lucky day. David's, among other areas, area is patents, and his current research interests are areas of software and business method patents, subject matter patentability, the law and economics of the U.S. patent system, and international regulation of intellectual property. So he is very well suited to be on today to discuss these issues. Prior to coming to CIS from 2000 to 2001, he served as a law clerk to the Honorable Jerry E. Smith of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in Houston, Texas. And for those of you, again, who aren't lawyers, that is the level of federal courts right below the United States Supreme Court. He's admitted to the bars of New York and California and in various federal courts as well. Pertinent to our discussion today, he's also litigated numerous patent cases, including cases involving casino card shufflers and Amazon's patented one-click technology. So David, I think, is going to be able to really enlighten you today on the very strange and pretty controversial area right now in intellectual property, which is patent law. So after we take another short musical break, I'll come back and we'll start our discussion. There we have the Grateful Dead off Reckoning. That's Dire Wolf. And before that, by the way, that was Yoshimi off Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. That is the great song Fight Test. So I'm pleased today to have with me David Olson. David, are you there?
I'm here.
Terrific.
Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. So let's dive right in, but before we do that, kind of define our terms. What exactly is a patent?
So that's a good question. A patent is what the government gives you, a monopoly right over an invention that you have invented, and it's kind of a quid pro quo system to get this 20-year solitary right to make, use, or sell the invention. In return, the inventor has to file a patent application which discloses all of the elements of the patent, how to make the patent. And the basic idea is both, A, we incentivize production of new inventions because people will be able to sell their product for a good price since they have a monopoly right. And B, we make an inventor give over the information on how to do the invention. So after the 20 years period expires, other people can do it.
So patents themselves, when they're filed, actually disclose quite a bit of information about what's being patented, and that's something that the public can access.
That's exactly right, and it's in direct opposition to what you listed as one of the big four categories of IP law: trade secrets. I actually would disagree with you that trade secrets in the top four. I just say the big three, and then there's kind of the unwanted stepchild.
Well, I'm a trade secrets guy.
I know you are. I know you just wrote a paper on that, so you have a vested interest. But
so just the logistics. How does one go about filing a patent, and what is it that can be patented?
So the patent statute says that you can patent a method, a process, a manufacturer. So basically there are different kinds of patents. You can patent a thing, you know, so a better mousetrap. You can patent a process of doing things. So the archetypical example would be the assembly line that builds your better mousetrap. You know, you have some unique steps in that assembly line. You can patent that process. Or more directly, you can patent a process for making a drug would be a good example.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to patenting something, there's it seems to be, and we're kind of moving a little bit in the direction I'd like to go, which is some of the unique permutations in the law. But it seems like, at least as we're going right now, more and more things can be patented that previously may not have been.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's interesting. The Supreme Court just last week had taken a case on. It was fully briefed. And then at the last minute, it was argued. The Supreme Court said, you know what, we're not going to decide this case. And it was about that very issue. What can be patented and what can't? What's proper subject matter for patentability? So, you know, in the back in the old days before, for instance, the information age and the computer revolution, it was pretty simple. You know, some commentators have said that a patent is something, you know, to be patentable, it has to be something you can put in a bag and shake and it makes noise. So, you know, an invention. But over time, that's really expanded. Computers came on the scene. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of amazing inventions that have been done, software and hardware, regarding computers that you can't really put in a bag and shake and have it make noise, at least on the software side. Yeah, they still have a lot of value, and we still want to incentivize their production. And so over time, courts, the Federal Circuit in particular, and also the Supreme Court to a lesser extent, have given way more and more ground to patentability, so that we've gotten to the day and age where, for example, not only can you patent computer software, you can patent methods of carrying out systems on computers, you can patent methods of business. So, for instance, a method of Priceline's method of selling tickets over the Internet is patented. You can even patent sports moves is one that people I always find are surprised by. But there is a patented golf swing. And if you learn the swing from the patent disclosure and use it on the golf course, just be careful, because if the patent holder catches you, you know, he can sue you for that.
And so we're talking about things that obviously not only aren't tangible, but literally are things that may just generate from someone's thinking about something and saying, oh, that's an idea. I'm going to go straight to the patent phase.
Well, so the patent, it's not supposed to be that way. And the patent law, in fact, is held, the Supreme Court has held for centuries now, or more than a century anyway, that you cannot patent laws of nature, natural phenomena, or abstract ideas. But interestingly enough, there has been a lot of pressure on that boundary, because at the end of the day, the difference between an abstract idea and a applied process, you know, a process is a series of steps for doing something. We might have an idea about a way to go about doing something, and at some point you get to a level of concrete enough detail when you're writing down, here's how you do this, that it's patentable. But that boundary has been eroding away, and the case I was mentioning earlier, the LabCorp versus Metabolite case that the Supreme Court dismissed last week because it was in the end decided not to hear it, wasn't ready to hear the case. Was exactly that kind of a case. That was. Are you familiar with the facts of that case? Would you like you to?
Well, I think it'd be good. I think I'm generally familiar, but for the benefit of the listeners, why don't we do a 2-minute summary if you can?
Absolutely. It's in fact, it's really easy to summarize. The patent, there was a single claim at issue. Let me give you a little factual background. Some scientists in the 80s studying vitamin deficiencies noticed that when there was a reduced level of the amino acid called homocysteine in the blood, this correlated with reduced levels of B12 and folate. And so the doctors came up with the idea of, well, let's test for this amino acid. And based on the test results, we know if we have a vitamin deficiency, then we, you know, give you vitamin supplements. And I believe that this is correct. I believe that you need to know if there's a vitamin deficiency before you give a lot of supplements, because too much folate or B12, I think, is not necessarily good for you. I'm not positive on that. But anyway, so what they did, in addition to figuring out this scientific correlation, is they came up with a better way to test for it. They came up with a test using gas, using some gas chromology methods that tested for...
Very scientific methods.
Yes, very scientific methods that tested for it better. So they filed a patent on that, and that's all well and good and within the norms of the patent law and how things work. But what they also did is they filed, and when you file a patent, you have many claims you can make. So each claim is considered a separate invention. So you describe what you've done, but then you can have claim one where you describe your invention this way, claim two, you would describe it a different way. And one of their claims was very broad, and that claim simply said, test for the presence of this amino acid. And if it's at certain levels, then that means, you know, then notice that that probably means vitamin deficiency. And that I really am summing up the patent claim right there.
I know it's a complex opinion that kind of moves in an interesting direction, because it sounds like what's ultimately coming out of that case is again an expansion of the ability of one to patent materials that really, you know, based upon the history of patent law, wouldn't have been patentable. What you've mentioned incentivizing innovation, and that's something that comes up regularly in intellectual property. We had Professor Jana Demers from USC on a few weeks ago talking about the ability of copyright to incentivize the creation of musical works. And, you know, clearly in the world of trade secrets, the idea of the secret idea process, what have you, that itself by its very secrecy creates a certain benefit to a business, you have incentives there. Trademarks, similarly, I think, involve, again, the incentives, the idea that you create a logo or what have you, and you're able to brand that logo, and as a result of building up the brand recognition for a company or anything else, you have that incentivized world where that logo can't be stolen. Patent law, though, seems to operate slightly differently, and you talked about it, and I want to just kind of explore it a little bit. You're talking about, in patent law, a limited monopoly, correct?
That's right.
And that limited monopoly exists in return for certain public disclosures. How does the, just in general terms, how does the economic incentive work there? Is it the monopoly factor that is the incentive, or are there other elements to a patent which gives it particular power and therefore is of particular interest to an inventor?
Sure. Well, it's so... Patents, just like copyright, certainly like copyrights, are what economists and social scientists call a public good problem, or inventions are, rather. And what that means is if you invent a better mousetrap and you spend, let's say, $100,000 in your research and development costs inventing it, and then you start selling the mousetrap and everyone copies your mousetrap, they didn't have to invest the $100,000. They just start selling the mousetrap with only the cost that it is to produce it. Well, then at the end of the day, your competitors make money, but you've ended up $100,000 in the hole because, you know, price gets competed down to a competitive level. So that means that you don't want to spend the time inventing this better mousetrap unless you have some sort of protection, either a first mover advantage or what our system has come up with is the patent. And the idea of the patent is that you will be incentivized to produce this better mousetrap because after you produce it for 20 years, you are the only one who can sell it. So you can obviously charge some nice high prices, as happens in with drug sales, right? Patented drugs cost a huge amount of money. As soon as they go off patent, generics flood the market for, you know, 1/20th of the price.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea of the patent system, is to incentivize through giving you a monopoly right over your product. But the thing that makes patents different, I would say, than copyright, because copyright's really similar, right? You're the only one who can sell the book that you write. It's exactly the same thing. With patents, since an invention, you know, the book in copyright is the thing. People read it. They know what it is. But it's quite possible to produce things like drugs and for people not to be able to know how you made the drug or not to know it without a great deal of reverse engineering, et cetera. So the patent system demands something extra from the creator of the product or of the invention, and that is that they disclose. Tell us how you made it. You don't get the patent unless you tell us how you made it. So if you're a company and you have a great product, you have to decide, basically, do I want to keep secret how I made this, in which case I can't get the strong patent protection, but, you know, trade secrecy law will apply if someone tries to steal my secret, Or am I going to go for the 20-year patent, in which case I tell everybody how I made it, but if anybody wants to use it, they either have to buy it from me or take a license from me to produce it.
It seems like, it seems like as a result, patent law really is in many ways a very democratic concept, democratic in the small d perspective, from the standpoint of its ability to allow public access. And I'm correct, I believe I'm correct that one could, if they want to check patents, simply go to the Patent and Trademark Office website. Is that right?
That's right. Anyone can go to www.uspto.gov, and you can, the site's pretty sophisticated now. It's gotten much better than it was, you know, a number of years ago. And you can do searches for all types of patents. You know, do you wonder if there's an invention around to help you exercise while you're in your lazy boy watching TV? Well, if you search for that in this system, you'll find out that, in fact, there is such an invention, and it has both foot leg exercisers at the end of your lazy boy recliner, and it has some arm paddles, so you can pull on those while you watch TV.
You know, it's funny. We're going to go into a short music break in a few minutes, and I think on the other side I'd like to talk about some of those funny patents. But it really, in taking a look today, just preparing for today's show, I looked at some websites that have the history of patents and funny patents and what have you, and it goes all the way back to the first patent that was allowed to patents that were created in the late 19th century to flying machines. And in law school, we learn about the carbolic smoke ball, the ball of smoke that was supposed to, if you inhale it, I think solve colds and what have you, right up to the present day. It seems like from, and we can talk about it on the other side, but it sure seems like patent law, and is certainly spurring the inventive spirit, and whether it stirred it in 1795, it doesn't seem like it's changed in terms of that kind of incentive right up to today, because as you mentioned, and we'll talk about on the next break, there are tons of inventions that you look at, and you look at the schematics that were driven. I mean, you know, the flying stuff, I think, is some of the funniest stuff from today's perspective, but you see these drawings of individuals with what appear to be enormous wings attached to their arms, and you wonder how would they do that? Why would they do it? Why would they invent it? And it stands to reason that it was because, obviously, they thought this was something that they could make money off of and something that they wanted to get credit for inventing.
Well, you know, that's the American dream right there, right? And it's certainly a lot of people try to pursue that through the patent system. Although I should note that there's no real requirement to get a patent that your invention work. I mean, it's supposed to work, but you can look up a lot of patents that have been granted on perpetual gravity or perpetual motion machines, rather. And unless the laws of science have changed, those generally don't end up going on and on and on as the patent holders say that they would.
With the metabolite case, I guess last point before we go into the break, I've noticed that there are numerous patent cases that are now before the Supreme Court. In maybe a 2-minute nutshell, I'm not asking you, I love to ask the question of predict the future, but I as a litigator myself, I never like getting that question. I'm not going to ask you to do that, but I will ask you it in a slightly different way, which is, what are the big issues right now, maybe a couple of big issues that we can discuss in more detail, that patent lawyers and therefore inventors and people looking to patent items should be aware of?
Yeah, absolutely, and I don't mind making some predictions on that, and I think it'll lead to an interesting discussion in the next segment, which is, we've talked about the bright side of the patent system so far, but there is a dark side. You mentioned that you can see that a lot of people are being incentivized to invent by the patent system, but at the same time, a lot of people think, and I tend to agree, that the patent system has gotten far enough out of whack that nowadays a lot of people are being prevented from inventing or prevented from following up on scientific research. A good example is that many of the tools that scientists, specifically biotech scientists, use in their research are now patented, and you have to pay prohibitive license fees if you want to use these kind of building blocks of science.
Hmm.
So, you know, there are these kind of issues. So I think two of the big issues are going to be, one, what is patentable? You know, what sort of things should really, you know, testing for a heightened level of amino acid, and then thinking about aha, this probably means vitamin deficiency. Should you be able to patent someone thinking of a correlation? That's going to be one big issue. The Supreme Court didn't address it in the metabolite case, but I think they will in a case that's more appropriate. Another big issue is, and this is more to do with the patent office, is that the system for granting patents, everyone pretty much agrees, has gotten really out of whack. 80% of or more of all patents that are applied for are eventually granted. But when it comes to litigation, less than 50% of the patents that have been granted actually hold up and are found to be valid patents. As soon as you start looking in more detail at what's been done before, you often find out, like, hey, this had actually been done before, and someone's claiming an invention on it when it wasn't new.
And the patent office isn't catching all of those. That requires litigation.
Well, yeah, so the number of patents filed every year has gone up and up and up, and right now you have the patent office, which is supposedly kind of scouring the earth to decide whether this is a new invention or not, but in reality spends an average of 27 hours over the 2 years that it takes to get a patent. Only 27 hours examining that patent, looking at prior art, and looking at the disclosure. And when you come to patents, some of which are 60 pages long, I mean, you know, your first 6 hours just went away trying to read and understand the patent. And, mm-hmm. and with your remaining 21 hours, you really can't always do a good job of figuring out what should be patentable and what shouldn't.
Well, I think that 80% number is something actually to think about a little bit on the break. Let's go into a short musical break, and when we return, continue the discussion. That's the great Jim Croce, guy who died way too young and really put out some amazing music in his very short time recording. But that's his classic, You Don't Mess Around With Jim. You know, before we go back to David, I wanted to point out, if you love what you're listening to right now, and I hope you do, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music, shows, sporting events, and news. By visiting kzsu.org and clicking on Donate to KZSU, you can do your part to make sure our independent sound never dies. And it's particularly important for radio stations that aren't operating on a commercial basis to have that support. So I sincerely hope that you enjoy what you're listening to, and I hope that you'll perhaps make a donation. So we were talking about, David, the custom-made pool cue from the Jim Croce song. And it's kind of a nice parallel. I wonder if he might have patented that. But let's talk a little bit about some of the strange 80% of the patents that are out there and some of the strange applications. This is just to have an idea, again, of the range that we're dealing with. Let's start off, you know, one that you think of that's particularly humorous, but also illustrative of what you can patent and what you can do with it.
So on a product patent, you have, for instance, on a method patent, so it's a method of doing something, you have a patent on a method of exercising a cat with a laser pointer. So the idea is that, you know, you point your little laser pointer at the ground, there's a little red light, cat will chase it because, you know, that's what they do, at least when they're kittens.
This is not the laser pointer that's being patented.
No.
It's the method of training the cat with the pointer.
The method of exercising the cat.
Excuse me.
You don't have to have a trained cat for this.
Uh-huh. And that's something that actually was patented.
That is. I mean, so if I'm at a a social get together and I find people are generally amazed at the range of things that you can patent. People will come up to me sometimes and say, you know, I have this idea, but I'm not sure if it's patentable. And I usually will say, oh, I'm pretty sure it's patentable. And they say, well, wait, don't you want to hear the idea? And I say, well, I'm pretty sure it's patentable. Now, whether it would hold up in a court of law, I don't know, but you can probably make it through the first hoop of patentability pretty easily.
The problem with patenting these things, just so I'm clear, is that you wind up monopolizing all kinds of things that really should be in the public domain or should not be capable of being captured for economic value. Is that right?
Well, so it's a good point. I mean, at the end of the day, no one cares. We don't really care that someone patented exercising a cat with a laser pointer, right? I mean, maybe it wastes a little government resources to have reviewed that patent, although I doubt they even spent the typical 27 hours. But, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to exercise your cat with a laser pointer in your home and someone's going to come in and say, hey, you have to stop that, and I'm going to sue you. So, you know, at the end of the day, most patents, another interesting statistic is that most patents end up being worthless.
Uh-huh.
Only well under 10% of all patents that are issued are ever commercialized.
So the laser pointer for the cat, has that done particularly well, do you know?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what you would sell there, right?
Yeah.
You know, they already gave away in the patent the little picture that shows you how to do it. So, no, I'm not aware of that generating a great deal
of income. You know, I had a cat, and I didn't realize I could have patented it. But, again, dating myself, in the 80s, there was a gypsy moth epidemic that hit the East Coast where these enormous moths were flying around and killing trees. And my method of exercising my cat was actually to point the cat towards the moths and then watch as my cat flailed around to eat the moths. The cat actually put on weight that summer as I trained the cat to chase a moth and consume it, as cats do. You're telling me, and just so I understand it, that if I had thought that this method of teaching the cat to go after a gypsy moth would have some pecuniary gain, I could have patented that idea under current standards.
Well, whether you thought there'd be pecuniary gain or not, and that sounds like two patents to me, Dave.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we've got a divisional going on there. We want to file your initial patent on exercising the cat, but then we've got a separate divisional patent, I believe, on a method of feeding the cat. I mean, sure, cats hunting down their prey has been around for a while, but I think, you know, you combine it with the particular flight patterns and nutritional value of a gypsy moth. We might have to do some work, but
right.
We find the right patent lawyer.
Well, you know, perhaps it's something I should revisit. Who knows? It seems like also it kind of touches on another area, which is the idea of patenting human characteristics or genomes and that kind of stuff. And we were talking about it with the metabolite case. Does that have the same level of controversy as stem cell research and things like that? It seems like this is the kind of stuff that doesn't have as much of the religious element to it that the stem cell research issues do. But it definitely has this ethical issue of capturing the value of what is created, you know, or something which you don't create as a human being. And I'm not getting religious on that, but the bottom line is, you know, you can't patent breathing oxygen, correct? Because that's something that a human being does, but you could patent a method of breathing, or a way to, from what you're telling me, a way to breathe if you're a runner or something like that. Does this have the same level of controversy, or should it? So where, you know, I know it's kind of a broad question, but I want to throw it out there and see if you have any thoughts on it.
Yeah, well, so, you know, patents on things like the like genes and the human genome don't have the same kind of controversial level that stem cell research does. You know, whether they should is another matter.
Right.
And actually, most of those patents separate out a little, and they'll patent the gene in a particular suspension or in a particular way that you've isolated the gene, but it amounts to, in all practical purposes, that you've patented the gene. Hmm. And so there's kind of two sides to the debate. One saying, look, it's enormously valuable to discover these genetic sequences and these genes and what they do and so forth. And so it makes sense to incentivize it by, you know, if someone figures it out, letting that person have exclusive control for 20 years of that particular, you know, gene sequence. On the other hand is the argument you make, which is, I think, pretty compelling, and that's, you know, this is a natural phenomenon. It's the sort of thing we generally haven't allowed to be patented, and, you know, there's some real problems, whether they be ethical or practical, pragmatic, with allowing someone else to patent a gene sequence and supposedly have, you know, exclusive control over making, using, or selling it when, you know, some other gene therapy might come along and that gene may be in your body and you may want the gene therapy to solve some medical problem, to kind of allow someone to extract monopoly prices, or, as patents allow you to do, to, in fact, just not allow someone to use your invention, you know, that could really raise some ethical issues. And I haven't really seen them discussed thus far. Everybody gets excited about stem cells instead, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's maybe a topic of an article that we can co-author, or I'm happy to sell you. I'll patent the idea and then sell you the right to go ahead and write something about it if you'd like.
That's a good idea. There's actually, speaking of interesting patents, a patent that's an application that's published. It hasn't been granted yet, but it's a patent on a method of applying for a patent.
Oh, there we go.
And so I think some, you know, some patent attorney out there is just seeing, well, how far can we push this?
Well, let's talk about one of those cases that I mentioned in the beginning that you've been involved with, and I think it brings us back around to the technology world. Everyone, I think, or most everyone who's used a computer and attempted to buy a book probably has gone to Amazon.com. It's almost become synonymous with book selling on the Internet. And you were involved in the one-click technology case. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit about that case, again, from the patent perspective and from the technology perspective?
Sure. So just to clarify, I was involved in kind of a second one-click case. There was a first case back in 98 where Amazon sued Barnes & Noble right before Christmas, and Amazon had this patented one-click technology. What that means is you find, after you've registered on the site and given them your credit card and your shipping address and all that, you can turn one click on, and you go, you find a book, maybe a CD you're looking for, maybe a Jim Croce album. You want to buy it.
I'm always looking for those.
Yeah. Well, if you turn your one click on, once you find that page with the album on it, you can just click the buy now with one click button, and boom, your credit card's charged. It sends it out via your preferred shipping method, and you know. So this was an innovative step that Amazon took. Of course, people liked it, and Barnes & Noble copied it and came up with a one-click method of selling of their own. But Amazon had patented that method and then sued Barnes & Noble and got a preliminary injunction just before Christmas in time to get all of the shopping business over at Amazon, because at Barnes & Noble you'd still have to go through the annoying registration process.
And a preliminary injunction, just for the non-lawyers, it stops them from doing what they're doing.
Right. So that's at the beginning of a lawsuit. Before you've even won your suit, you just go to the judge and say, look, I have a patent. And patent's a unique area where you kind of have a presumption that you'll be granted an injunction, although the Supreme Court recently backed off that a little in the eBay case. Still, it's fairly unique in that the court will say, aha, if it looks like you have a likelihood of success in your lawsuit, then sure, we'll make the other party stop practicing or using your invention until the case is over.
Uh-huh.
So Barnes & Noble was slapped down, and what did they end up doing in that case? Well, they ended up coming up with a two-click system, it's really arguable how much business was stolen, taken away by Amazon because of that. But it's an interesting case. The case that I was involved in, and actually that case back then generated a lot of controversy, and a lot of people were very angry at Amazon for patenting what they thought was either an obvious thing to do on the Internet. You always want to simplify the shopping experience, right? On the other hand, Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, came out and said, no, what's revolutionary is that we got out of the mindset of the shopping cart where you fill your cart and then you go through a checkout one at a time and then you pull out your money and pay. The revolutionary thing is that we destroyed that kind of thinking, that the shopping cart metaphor was destroyed with one click, and now it's just point at what you want and you have it.
Even though they do call it the shopping cart.
Well, no, see, with one click, you don't have to put things in the shopping cart. That's another option for you.
Oh, okay, I see.
You find the page you like, boom, one click, and it's on its way to you.
So that's it. There's no filling out of forms or anything. You've already pre-filled everything out, and you just scroll through the site and find what you want.
That's exactly right. Now, some critics will say, well, you could have an account with the grocery store, and you'd call them up and say, I need a bottle of milk. Can you send that over? I'm going to come by and pick that up. And, and some critics would say it's not so revolutionary, that idea has been around for a while. And in fact, the case ended up being settled after the preliminary injunction was granted. It went up on appeal to the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit overturned the injunction, saying that it thought that Amazon's patent may end up being found obvious. At that point, of course.
Meaning what?
Meaning you can't have a patent on something. To get a patent, something either has to be new. It has to be new, and it also has to be non-obvious, as in, just because no one else has done it before, if it's as obvious as the day is long, that's not the kind of thing we're going to give you a patent for. That's not an invention that we need to give you a 20-year monopoly on.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some of the reasons I was saying, maybe it's obvious to, always simplify the shopping process such that we don't really want to give Amazon a 20-year monopoly and make it more difficult for every other e-commerce site out there to have customers pay.
Mm-hmm.
So they settled because Amazon didn't, presumably because Amazon didn't want to have its patent possibly invalidated, because if a court below had found the patent to be obvious, then boom, the patent goes away. It's now worthless. Amazon doesn't have it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the case I worked on was a different case, and this was a patent prosecutor, so someone who writes patent applications, and this is happening more and more. You have these people who write patent applications, and they start thinking to themselves, boy, there are people getting rich here off these patents, and they start writing their own patent applications. And in this case, a guy in Virginia wrote a patent application on a simplified ATM screen system. And his idea was, you know, when you go to the ATM and you have to type in your code, and then you have to select the type of transaction, and then how much you want, and then confirm, et cetera. He thought his patent started out saying there's been a long, you know, long felt need in the industry to not waste so much time at ATM, because I know that that's just everyone's, you know, that's a big problem for everyone, all those, you know, wasted seconds and minutes at an ATM machine. So his grand idea was to put all of the choices on one screen right at the beginning. You just have to look at one screen, you make all your choices, and you hit OK, and boom, you get your money coming out. You don't have to go through six different screens. And so he tried to sell that to various banks. I mean, he really wanted to have this be a patent that he would make money on. And the banks kind of came back to him, we found out in the course of discovery, the ATM people, and said, you know, we've actually thought of this, but it's not a good idea because people get confused with all these choices on one screen. It's easier for people to go through a process, a path. What kind of transaction do I want? Balance transfer, withdraw cash.
And so it gives you time to really ruminate about your decision-making as you go through the arcane and difficult process of hitting a button.
That's right. Well, it's interesting. There's a huge science of graphical user interfaces, of how to present choices to people in a computer or, you know, display setting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's been found repeatedly that simpler, less choices at any one stage of the process is generally easier for people. So, for instance, you have that soundboard in there which has tons of dials and switches and knobs and whatnot. I would be completely flabbergasted if you asked me to have to run that thing.
Well, I may be flabbergasted as well, but I'm able to work it so far.
And I think you're doing a great job.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm fishing for compliments here on anything, you know, anything involving engineering. So, no, I appreciate that. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, so the Amazon case that I worked on, this guy, after he was unable to commercialize his invention, after, you know, Bank of America and other banks said, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. We like our ATMs fine the way they are. Then the next step of your patent holder, and this is not atypical, is to say, huh, no one would buy my invention, but does that mean my patent's worthless? Not necessarily, because if, in the LabCorp metabolite case, if you have a broad patent claim, then you can look around and say, well, who could I possibly sue? Who could I say this patent applies to? And in our case, it was Amazon. The patent holder said, well, look, I had a patent, and his patent came out before Amazon's patent. And it, you know, it says you have one screen, you do everything on one screen, and you click OK, and that completes, and these were keywords, an electronic financial transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, buying a book is an electronic financial transaction. Now there were other problems with his patent in that he'd kind of defined that within his patent as really meaning fund transfer.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is, it points up a larger problem in the world of patents. It's one of the things that's happened, I believe, over the last decades is there's an ability to write these broad, kind of general, vague claims, and then you just kind of can go fishing later on and say, well, who does this cover? And so in this case, I mean, I can't reveal how much, but believe me, Amazon spent a lot of money defending the case,
mm-hmm.
and when we ultimately prevailed and his patent was invalidated, as it should have been. You can have what's known in the industry as patent trolls, and these are people who either collect patents, they buy them from inventors, or they invent them themselves. They don't try to commercialize them. They don't want to make a product, but they get a bunch of patents together. Say it's on silicon chip making technology or something like that, where you have hundreds of patents that apply to any one, Intel chip. And they come along and they say, look, we're going to sue you, and if we get an injunction, we're going to shut down all of your process, just like with the RIM BlackBerry case. If you remember in the news, BlackBerry was worried about getting its system shut down because a Canadian patent holder was suing BlackBerry. you know, and saying that the mail server system that BlackBerry used had been patented and they were violating it. And so at the end of the day, RIM, the company that owns that produces the BlackBerries, ended up paying a lot of money mm-hmm. because of the fear of being shut down. So the dark side of patents is this this fact that you don't have to have developed an invention that you're selling and someone comes along and rips off. You can come up with a fairly vague invention with your, or an invention that has various vague claims, and then as long as the claim language fits, even if it's, even if you can look at your patent and say, well, this was a patent on ATM technology, not on buying things on the internet with one click, but as long as the language of the claim, which is a specific part of the patent, fits, you can sue anyone who you want to. And so what that does is it really kind of puts a toll on innovation, and it puts a toll on the price of business.
And it's interesting, in the remaining minutes that we have left, the patent troll problem, the idea of entities simply gobbling up patents and then trying to extort money basically from people that want to use it, even in a situation where the patent itself wasn't being exploited, seems to undermine entirely the whole purpose of the patents, unless it is the fact that they acquired the patent for some amount of money, and in the acquisition, the idea was they wanted to buy it because they could therefore charge rent, basically, to use it. But the patent troll problem, I know, is a major issue, especially in technology right now, is it not?
Yeah, that's right. And just to kind of nuance a little bit what you said, you do want patents out there to incentivize people to invent things and then either to sell them, you know, to the public, or it's actually fine if they don't sell them, but if they license other people to sell them, right? Mm-hmm. You want patents on things that are new and useful, non-obvious, that adds kind of to the GDP. But when you have the case of someone who comes up with an invention and no one else, you know, ripped off the invention, no one used this patent to, you know, Amazon didn't look at this ATM technology patent to come up with a one-click system, so mm-hmm. It didn't get any head start there. Instead, enforcing the patent is purely what economists call rent-seeking behavior. It's purely taking money from one party and putting it in your own pockets, and that kind of behavior decreases GDP. It kind of makes the whole economy run a little slower.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's from the one-click to the cat trainer to the flying machines that I was looking at online, it seems like patent law in all of its permutations still seems to be operating in its basic intended way, which is to give people an opportunity to try to make a buck off of what they come up with. I wonder, as kind of a closing question, where do you think the whole incentive argument is going in the tech world? There's a lot of debate that, you know, Larry Lessig, who we both work for, writes about commons, as a number of other professors, Brett Frischman and Jamie Boyle and what have you, and all of these arguments basically seem to turn on the idea partially that you don't need necessarily an economic incentive to innovate. Patent laws seems to be built on that, but do you have an opinion as to that very, very cutting edge, very controversial opinion that's floated around and that's really being kicked around more and more as intellectual property law becomes as pervasive as it is?
Sure, and I don't think I really disagree with you. I disagree with what you just said, but I think it's just because of the way you said it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Larry Lessig or Jamie Boyle or those people think that incentives aren't needed for patent law or even for copyright. But I think what they do
That they're not needed as much as – and I guess I did put it that way – but that it's not the only criteria to use to determine whether something should be copyrighted, whether something should be patented, whether something should be trademarked or what have you.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so I
thank you for correcting that.
Sure. You know, since we're talking about our boss.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. That's a good idea.
But
just between us.
Right.
It's just between us, so don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah, just us. And so, you know, at the end of the day, you need these incentives and to get people to, you know, not many writers would write if they couldn't make a living at it. They wouldn't sit in their basement, you know, kind of on their off hours and write. Some still would, but a lot wouldn't. And the same thing with inventions. Some would still invent, but a lot wouldn't. So we need this for an incentive. And I love the patent system and the idea of the patent system, but what needs to happen is we need to make certain reforms so that only good non-obvious novel inventions are patented. And the real problem that Larry Lessig, Jamie Boyle, and others talk about is that we are encroaching, I think, on the commons in that what we want to do, really, at a theory, philosophical level, is we want to pay people to invent and to write things the minimum fair amount that we have to pay them, i.e. we need to, you know, with a patent, we only give it for 20 years. Copyright is really out of whack in that we say you can have the exclusive right to control your work and even, you know, someone quoting from it or being inspired by it and writing, you know, a sequel or something for the life of the author plus 70 years. And so, that's a real problem. When copyright or when patent law is operating properly and the patents aren't too broad and they're not being given on things like business methods, which I think they shouldn't be, and it only lasts for 20 years, that's a pretty fair exchange. And I think it works best probably in the drug world where it's really expensive to get through FDA approval. You do it, you get a 20-year monopoly, you get to charge a lot of money, and then we all benefit when it comes off patent and we get to buy the generics.
Well, that that last word, I think, is probably where we're going to have to close today. David, I know that I can be reached, as you can, by checking out CIS's website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. You can certainly read about the work that CIS is doing generally, but also kind of follow the trials and tribulations of the resident fellow at CIS and all the fun stuff that's happening here. I want to thank you, David, for coming in today. I appreciate you taking the time. And also, I just want to point out some of the upcoming guests that are coming up in the next few weeks. Corey Davison, the Legislative Affairs Director for the Concord Coalition, will be in to discuss technology in the world of Washington inside the Beltway. I'm also looking forward to having Colin Rule from eBay on to discuss online dispute resolution, and Fred Herman, who's the director of New Jersey's Election Law Enforcement Commission, a state that has been doing a lot of work in the area of campaign finance and technology. So, David, thanks for coming in today.
It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. My guest today was David Olson, my fellow resident director, here to make sure that he not only are we having interesting discussions, but that we're able to convey what is really a very complex area in relatively listenable terms for those that are not lawyers. But I want to thank David tremendously for coming in today, for engaging in what I think was a terrific discussion, and I certainly invite him back in the future if he wants to continue the discussion and kind of follow up on some of the cases. So, David, I hope you'll at least consider that.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Well, this has been Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. You're listening to KZSU Stanford. And thank you very much for listening today. And enjoy the rest of today's programming here on KZSU. I encourage you to stay on and listen.